Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford, and good afternoon, everyone. Hope you're having a very fine Sabbath day. I was not planning to say this, but I have to say it's very humbling to be walking in the footsteps of men like Mr. Fay and Mr. Rowanspiece, and the bar is set rather high. So with that, let's get into our message, which I've called Pursuing the Path of the Romans. Pursuing the Path of the Romans. And we'll turn over to Matthew 24. Matthew 24 is a chapter that perhaps we have all turned to scores of times, and with good reason, because it was one of the greatest chapters of prophecy in the entirety of the Bible. Matthew 24, beginning in verse 1, we read how Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." And thus begins a chapter which is filled with one of the greatest prophecies given by Christ. And we know, if you have had the opportunity to visit, where not one stone is left after 70 AD when the Romans came in and utterly destroyed the temple. We're going to focus a little more on the disciples, starting in verse 3. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Now, several questions in here, but the focus is they wanted to know, what were the signs? How will we know that you are on your way? And Jesus' first words are, "Watch." Watch out that no one deceives you. And implicit in that statement is that many would be deceived. And in fact, we do believe that the majority are deceived. Christ continues, "Many come in my name, saying, 'I am the Messiah.'" Certainly, there are untold numbers of preachers who recognize Jesus Christ was the one prophesied to come at that time, in the early part of that century. He said, "I am the Messiah, but they will deceive many." Now he continues on with a number of other signs, but we're going to focus on what the disciples were asking for, was the signs that they would know that Christ was coming. Now, I prepared this at the time I was giving a message up in Beloit, and happened to be the very day after the inaugural address by the new president, Mr. Donald Trump. I felt it's appropriate to reflect at times when there is a changing administration, when there's deep division, whether the country is headed in the right way or whether this new or, in fact, any administration is able to halt what seems like a toboggan slide downward in so many areas. So we can step back, take a big picture snapshot of where not only the nation is going, but even the direction of the entire Western world. So with that, let's turn over to 2 Timothy. And in chapter 3, here once again, scripture that we've heard many times, even recently, and I suspect we will hear many, many more times in coming days. 2 Timothy 3, and I'll read it from not a translation, but rather from an interpretation, because I believe we are familiar with it. So the interpretation goes as follows, from verse 1. "But you must realize in the last days the times will be full of danger. Men will be utterly self-centered, greedy for money, full of big words. They will be proud and contemptuous, without any regard for what their parents taught them. They will be utterly lacking in gratitude, purity, and normal human affections. They'll be men of unscrupulous speech and have no control of themselves. They'll be passionate, unprincipled, treacherous, self-willed, conceited, loving all the time what gives them pleasure instead of loving God." This is a terrible indictment of this age. "They maintain a facade of religion, but their conduct denies its validity. You must keep clear of people like this. Avoid them. So we look not just to the leadership, but the tenor of these times and the overall direction of society itself. But how are we to do that?" Well, I'd like to illustrate this with an anecdote told by Mr. Herbert Armstrong on determining what the temperature of a building will be in a few hours. I wonder if a few of you might remember this. You go down to the boiler room. Now, the anecdote goes as follows. At a conference in January of 1920, at the height of a wave of post-war prosperity, A well-known statistician, Roger Babson, predicted America was going to enter the worst business depression that our generation ever experienced. Mr. Herbert Armstrong, who attended this meeting as a member of the Association of Commerce, related how many of the leading bankers and business executives of Chicago who were in attendance smirked at his suggestion. The times were good. Through the next few months, business activity continued its boom upswing. But before the end of 1920, the crash that Roger Babson predicted did strike with a sudden and intense fury. How did Babson know that a crash was on its way? Mr. Armstrong related what Babson said at a later conference where his opinion carried considerably more weight. It's now midwinter. If I want to know what the temperature is now in this room, I go to the wall, I look at the thermometer. If I want to know what it has been up to now and the existing trends of the moment, I look at a recording thermometer. But if I want to know what the temperature in this room is going to be 1 hour from now, I go to the source which determines future temperatures. I go down to the boiler room to see what's happening down there. You gentlemen look at your bank clearings and indexes of business activity, your stock market quotations, and you looking at the thermometer on the wall. I looked at the way people as a whole were dealing with one another. I looked at the source which determines future conditions. I found that that source may be defined in terms of righteousness. When 51% or more of the whole people are reasonably righteous in their dealings with one another, we're heading into increasing prosperity. When 51% of the people become unrighteous in their business dealings with their fellows, we are headed for bad times economically. Now, economics is just one lens through which to view the health of a nation, a society, even an entire civilization. So it's worth considering a civilization. And this is one that became an overextended empire, which, by coincidence or not, was physically almost the size of the United States. Almost by accident, they became the policemen of the world. Of course, I'm speaking of the Empire of Rome. But who were these Romans? And how is modern Western society following the same pathway today? The similarities are striking, and yet the lessons are not being learned. Recently, I've been considering what was in fact the very first piece of literature I ever received from the Church of God at a time when I was a teenager. This was under the pastorship of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. It was a booklet entitled The Modern Romans. I'm just curious, how many of you have heard of the booklet, The Modern Romans? Quite a few. And this booklet was, as I mentioned, the very first piece of literature I'd ever had. Now, it's well known in its day, Romans were the greatest power and civilization that this world had ever known. But at the same time, it was a debauched society that for a litany of reasons over many centuries seems to have crumbled into the ash heap of history, although we know there are in fact 10 resurrections of this Roman Empire. Are we pursuing the same path as the Roman Empire? Are we in fact the embodiment of modern Romans? While it's true this booklet by this same name was written in the mid-70s, more than 40 years ago, it does not weaken or dilute the impact of its message, and in fact, it is far truer today than it was when written. So today I'll use as a lens four of the major sections of this booklet via quotations, while showing how much closer we are today than when this book was written. First, let's begin with an overview of the power, the dominance of this world-ruling empire that began, rather like America, from humble beginnings as a small, insignificant settlement, a minor village on the Tiber River in Italy. From the website reference.com, it states at the peak of the Roman Empire's reach, around AD 117, the empire stretched as far north as modern Scotland, stretched down throughout Europe, east into Asia as far as the border between modern-day Iraq and Iran, with its southern reaches extending into northern Africa. At its heights, the Roman Empire had a geographic stake in up to 48 modern countries. After reaching its peak during the 100s, the empire faced a slow decline before losing much of its territory during the 5th century, finally collapsing in 476 AD. But the legacy of the Roman Empire is still strong in the modern world, including its influence on Western languages, codes of law, religion, and indeed a source of republican ideas. As an example, the name Senate itself derives from senex, literally meaning old man. That is where mature views prevailed. I was thinking that perhaps we could apply then senator to Mr. May or Mr. Bradford, but this is mature views. I hope nobody's laughing. I'm not sure why. I thought that was a good point. But if you do mention to Mr. D that he's a senator, you can give the context why. I mean, someone with maturity. But above all, Rome was most renowned for having developed its war-making capacities, the likes of which the world had never known. So to the average citizen, how could such a massive power crumble? Rome was impregnable. It had an unstoppable military and the greatest accumulation of wealth ever seen. Indeed, the whole world was Rome. Fate had decreed they would always be on top. And as we see these historical facts, I hope that you will see there are parallels between that and the modern Western world. The idea that, well, nothing can change, can it? I remember that one of the greatest lessons I learned in a foreign relations class at Ambassador College was one of the great mistakes of history is not recognizing when the status quo has changed. Now today I'm not going to say that the parallels with the decline and fall of the Roman Empire are exact, but the lessons of Rome should not be lost on us, especially during a time that there's relative calm and peace and safety within the country. Quoting from the booklets, to speculate at this moment of unsurpassed material and economic and military achievements that glorious Rome could collapse to inferior barbarians was unthinkable. And barbarians who, many of them took their stock or heritage from the Germanic tribes. What Roman Jeremiah could have prophesied the ravages of wars, taxation, mounting crime, race problems, moral decay, subversion from within, political assassinations, and public apathy, not excluding natural disasters, that these would one day bring Rome prostrate, lying on its face before less developed nations. Christian in name at the end of the 5th century, the empire in the West obviously did not have divine protection from the barbarian hordes that overran her. No nation that fails to fully respect and live by God's true moral standards ever does. And one of the most profound statements of Mr. Trump during his inaugural address was very, very brief. He stated, "We will be protected by God." And my immediate reaction after I got over the shock of his statement was, "How can you know that? How can you make that statement and know it?" He did not add the words, "only if we turn and repent." Back to Rome. It had prodigious engineering projects, the vast aqueduct works, high-rise buildings, its theater and cosmetic arts, spectator sports, sightseers and tourism, all words used to describe Rome in the 2nd century AD at the height of its power. And we can think Las Vegas. We can think New York. We can think Paris, for that matter. Their roadway system was a network equivalent to 5 times the length of the Earth's equator, and it has only been rivaled in modern times. According to historian Robert Strauss Hoop, if at any time in human history a people could have looked confidently to the future, it was the Roman people of the 2nd century. Yet within 100 years, this same author notes, Roman civilization was plunged into anarchy and poverty, ravaged by foreign aggressors, doomed to extinction. So, what lessons can we learn from the experience of Rome? Well, none. If we think we're a society wholly different, completely different from the people of ancient Rome, if we ignore the parallels with the average pleasure-seeking Roman, if we're like the average man or woman on the street, scarcely imagining a proud and mighty nation brought low before its enemies. So now after that very lengthy introduction, now down to the breakdown of the outline of the 4 sections. First is an economy in trouble. Next is overextension of military power. Third will be a craze for pleasure. And finally, the breakdown of the family. So we'll cover each of those at length. The first is the economy in trouble. Rome had extended herself, becoming as much by accident as design the dominant nation of the world, and the cost of maintaining this Pax Romana, or Peace of Rome, over the most of the known world was proving too great, even for the enormous resources of the empire. Rome attempted a policy of unrestricted trade, but the Roman working man was unable to compete with the chief foreign labor and demanded high tariffs. The government was finally forced to subsidize the Roman working class to make up the difference between their real wages, the actual value of what they're producing, and the wages required to keep up the relatively high standard of living. Just as in America and Britain today, spiraling wage increases are helping to cause inflation and are pricing American goods out of the world market. Lower cost imports are threatening the domestic market. As a result, thousands of workmen live on a subsidy, and they did nothing in the Roman Empire whatever, sacrificing their standard of living for a life of ease. Now, the costs of running this gigantic empire were massive. They caused a perpetual administrative struggle to maintain a stable economy. It took a veritable army of officials, think modern government, to man and work the complicated dual supply and demands of both government services and military. This necessitated laying greater burdens of taxation upon already overburdened people. No stone was left unturned for revenues. There were other economic problems that aggravated this revenue problem. Rising prices, the loss of purchasing power, the escape of the rich from taxation, the poor becoming poorer, the decline of production, even disease epidemics and drought decimating the provinces along with expensive wars, violently shook and weakened the economic superstructure of the empire. The copper-nickel sandwich coins today are signs of economic deterioration. But look at Rome's experience. By the third quarter of the third century, the silver coins became copper pieces, washed in silver. There was a vast inflation. By the end of the third century, prices had risen 200 times the second century level. And looking up some of the statistics of today, the dollar since 2000 has lost 40%. And from the time of the writing of the booklet called The Modern Romans, it's lost approximately 80% of its value. The Emperor Diocletian attempted to set price controls, an attempt that failed because there is seen only a mad desire without control to pay no heed to the needs of the many. Another significant factor that contributed to the breakdown of the character and spirit of the population was welfare. The dole became a way of life. At times, the city of Rome had one-third to one-half of its population receiving part or all of its subsistence from public charity. And from a CNSnews.com report called the 35.4%, as of the fourth quarter of 2012, 109 million Americans live in households receiving benefits from one or more federally funded means-tested programs, also known as welfare, according to the Census Bureau. This is more than the population of Texas, New York, Florida, and California combined. When we take those receiving benefits from other federal programs, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment, when they're added, it turns out that 153 million people are getting federal benefits. This was in the year 2012. Now, of these, it's interesting, the 153 million, that's greater than the entire population of Russia. In the fourth quarter of 2008, when Mr. Obama was elected, there were 96 million people living in households taking benefits. And after 4 years, that was grown by 13 million people. Now, back in 1902, the total bill for taxes of all kinds was $18 per capita. Can you imagine? Only $18 per person. By 1948, $377. By 1960, $709. In 1968, it was $1,000. And every year sees another rise. The historian William Stearns Davis wrote in The Influence of Wealth in Imperial Rome, as an almost unavoidable corollary of the huge Roman fortunes was the accumulation of debts. Even men of grave and respectable habits caught the mania of their age, which was living beyond their incomes. The typical Roman of birth and fashion was imagined to be regularly in debt, frequently on the brink of ruin. And a recent report, you may recall, said that here in America, The average American could not come up with $500 in the event of an emergency. And so continuing the quotation, the average American is in the same sinking financial boat. Total debt in the United States, both public and private, stands at an astronomical $2.7 trillion. Oh, but you say that's wrong. And you're right, it is wrong. That was back in 1975. So I went to the debt clock this morning. The debt clock states that at this morning, the debt of the United States was $19,939,000,000,000, and that the Bipartisan Policy Center at Washington Think Tank says that 2017 is the year. It hits $20 trillion. So I wonder if we can imagine $20 trillion. You may have heard the analogy. It really struck me. I heard it a number of years back of how to imagine $1 trillion. If you took $100 bills and stacked them up 7 feet high and then took multiple stacks of these 7 foot high $100 bill treasures, you could say, and put them on a football field, and you covered the football field from end zone to end zone, that would be $1 trillion. So now you have to imagine 20 football fields. That would be the approximate debt America owns. And to put this in perspective, MarketWatch reported the combined value of all 500 major corporations in the S&P 500. They were valued in total at $19.1 trillion as of the summer of 2016. That includes Apple, ExxonMobil, Facebook, and other giants. So they're less than the debt of the entire nation. Now, we've stayed away from the Bible a little too long, so let's turn over to the book of Deuteronomy. And keeping these thoughts in mind, let's observe the contrast with the way God wants it to be. Deuteronomy 28, we read of the blessings he would like us to have. Deuteronomy 28, beginning in verse 1. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of your Lord God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed you shall be in the city. Blessed you shall be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, your children, the produce of your ground, the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. And as an aside, I don't know if you know this, I heard some years back that more than 50% of the food that America consumes is brought in from outside the United States. More than half is now produced abroad. So continuing on, blessed shall you be when you come in. Blessed shall you be when you go out. The Lord your God will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face, that they shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. Can you imagine a little pipsqueak country like North Korea, approximately the size of Pennsylvania, threatening the United States under these conditions, where God is the God of America? Continuing on, the Lord will command the blessing on you in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand. He will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, just as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments, again, the conditional, of the Lord your God and walk in his ways, then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. And the Lord will grant you plenty of goods in the fruit of your body, the increase of your livestock, in the produce of your ground, the land which the Lord swore to the fathers to give you. Finally, verse 12, the Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And God repeats it, if you wish to jot it down, in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 6. For the Lord your God will bless you, just as he promised. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. Much of the debt of the United States must be underwritten by foreign powers at this point in time. And we will be moving on in a few moments to the next factor, but before continuing, it's interesting to note that two of America's largest creditors, which are Japan and China, have between them cashed in about $150 billion in just the last couple of years. Why is that? Why are they no longer willing to invest in America? No doubt it's very much for the reason we've been discussing, the astronomical debt. And just as an aside, I read recently how Canada, which is the 10th largest economy in the world, a think tank out of England has stated that Canada will lose that 10th spot in just the next couple of years to Korea. Korea will now take its place and will be a more productive nation than the nation of Canada. It's very surprising. You probably know that China has already overtaken the United States in gross national product. With that, we'll move on to the second factor. Remember, each of these is a lens through which we can view the signs that the disciples asked about. What will be the signs? And the second is a reliance on an overextension of the military. And quoting from the book, The Modern Romans, in a military age surrounded by nations becoming more aggressive, hostile, treacherous, Rome followed a policy that made her increasingly weaker defensively and more vulnerable to conquest. She thought her policies of defense would make her stronger, and for a while they did, but in the end they destroyed her. Now, it's a byword that the United States as a world power faces very perilous times. Iran, with its hidden nuclear facilities, and I remember reading how all four of the nuclear facilities which were hidden to government inspectors were actually divulged by underground resistance movements inside the country of Iran itself. It was not because of any signing of a contract. It was only because these underground fighters, you could call them, outed the Iranian government for the nuclear facilities they had. The contract, as you well know, that was made under then-Secretary Kerry, did nothing to curtail the ballistic development of the program. And in fact, now Iran, one can say, was guaranteed by that contract. They were guaranteed that they would become and would be allowed to become a nuclear power. And we move on to North Korea, which, even as you know, seems like they're now testing long-range ballistic missiles almost on a weekly basis. Now, again, Mr. Trump, in his inaugural address on January 2nd, said, oh, North Korea just stated it's in the final stages of developing a nuclear weapon capable of reaching parts of the U.S. It won't happen. And again, I have to say, how does he know that? How can he possibly know that? Also, the islands of the South China Sea. Very interesting area. I think that you probably have read up on it, that China's developing bases, artificial islands in the South China Sea, building up on them missile batteries, in fact, conducting tests on aircraft, mock aircraft carriers so they could take out those aircraft carriers. Clearly, it's becoming an expansive power. It's testing the will of America. So with that, you may wish to just jot this down, a very short quotation, which I remember hearing even good number of years back now on the World Tomorrow program, when Mr. Gardner Ted Armstrong was using this statement from Leviticus 26:19. Leviticus 26:19 says, I will break the pride of your power. I will break the pride of your power. So power is of no use unless it has a credibility factor, unless it's seen as being a viable power, one that will be used. And God has promised that he would break that power, going right back to the time of the Vietnam War. The first conflict that actually was a loss for the United States. Well, similarly, the Roman Empire was ringed by a wall of fortresses along the Rhine and the Danube River in Germany, the Euphrates in Arabia, in Africa. They had Hadrian's Wall in Britain. And America, likewise, has an unsinkable alliance, an unshakable friend in who? Japan and Germany. Isn't that ironic? I mean, just dwell on that for a moment. Who are the chief friends militarily, supposedly, because it seems like England itself has lost its military power. In fact, it's at the point now where it's stated that England could not even, were they to go to war again, such as in the Falklands in 1982. You may remember that Argentina threatened taking over those islands in 1982, and England said, no, you won't. And they went in there with Exocet missiles, and they were ready to take on the Argentinian army, and they took back control of the Falklands. So a statement recently said, couldn't do it today. England couldn't do that today if the exact same events were to take place. But back to the idea of Japan and Korea being the stalwart friends Korea among them, along with Germany, stalwart friends of America. Mr. Trump has made the pronouncement, well, Japan should go nuclear. Can you imagine that? Well, Japan, being a country that I am very interested in, and I try to read up on, in fact, there are calls within the country for remilitarization, and a bellwether mark took place just recently. They surpassed the 1% level for military upgrades. So they went beyond 1%. This is the first time since World War II that that has taken place. And there are literally calls within the country to go nuclear. In fact, I heard a conversation took place with a Toyota executive, and this executive was asked, well, will Japan ever develop a nuclear bomb? And his response, no, that could never happen. That couldn't possibly happen. And by the way, it's built into their constitution. Their constitution says they cannot develop a nuclear bomb. And then he thoughtfully reflected and said, but if we did, we would do it in under 6 months. And there's little doubt of that. So with this trust in these countries as an alliance, it's a question how sturdy that alliance truly is. And it's because, in part, America is being distrusted as an isolationist power. So Mr. Trump, and I thought this may be of interest, looked up what his military plans are. He plans to increase 90,000 Army soldiers, 350 ship Navy, 100 more fighters while strengthening nuclear and missile defenses. Sounds wonderful. Defense experts say this will cost $100 billion more than the current Pentagon budget, an amount that would cause or require Congress to change its laws for budget caps. But it's unknown where the money would come from. And given Mr. Trump's other plans to slash taxes while keeping entitlement programs and a $1 trillion infrastructure improvement program, Todd Harris for the Center for Strategic and International Studies says, I see big deficits in the future. And the question remains, and this tracks along with the first factor, where will the ability to afford such military come from? Rome faced the same question that we've seen. And after Mr. Trump's inaugural address, a very interesting headline from a news commentator named Charles Krauthammer, he said the following. He said, I want to make a point about Mr. Trump's speech, a part that we overlooked, that I'm sure was not overlooked around the world. There are two audiences for inaugural addresses, the domestic and the foreign. I guarantee you they are quaking in their boots in foreign capitals, particularly of allies and trading partners. The way that Mr. Trump spoke about the outside world was the most aggressive, most hyper-nationalist, in some ways most hostile of any inaugural address since the Second World War. And then watching the news coming out of Germany, Angela Merkel, the chancellor, has made a statement, and I'll paraphrase her statement. Her statement was, we can no longer trust old alliances. And this is very obviously directed toward Mr. Trump. We can no longer trust old alliances. It is time for Europe to come together and see to its own defense. At what point in time, and there have actually been headlines, which I won't take the time for now, but there have been headlines in the German press, is it time for Germany to go nuclear? I'll let you chew on that for a moment. So what we see is the pieces of the puzzle falling into place. We may be seeing this forced emergence of the 10th and final resurrection of the Holy Empire. It's interesting how under Mr. Obama's administration seemed to push Iran in the direction of becoming a regional power, perhaps the King of the South, perhaps not. But Germany right now seems to be pushed by Mr. Trump into moving off in its own direction, seeing to its own defense. And more than likely, the King of the North is arising under, perhaps not Angela Merkel. September 24th, by the way, is a date to keep in mind. It's the German elections. Whether or not Ms. Merkel retains power, she will clearly be headed out of power shortly after that time. And there are a number of people, interestingly, waiting in the wings who are much more bellicose. They're much more warlike than Ms. Merkel is. With that, let's go on to the third point, which is a mad craze for pleasure. And again, looking at the parallels to see, does this indicate what society is like now? It's quoting from the book, The Modern Romans. Indulge yourself. You owe it to yourself. Live it up now. And as many as can, do. Those who cannot do so literally, do so vicariously through unending access to entertainment. In an age of selfish materialism, few seriously question whether all this rapid consumption of indulgences is really good for them, or where will it all lead? What does Rome teach in its history about these trends? A Roman historian said this: "The Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, brought many blessings. It made possible the greatest luxury, the most active commercial life the world ever saw, and what were Rome's highest social values and goals? It was the excessive desire for wealth, without regards to methods or to duty toward posterity, the downright sensuality that were accomplishing their perfect work. The economic evil was at the bottom. First Italy, then a vast empire, devoting itself for centuries to getting money by any means possible and to spending it on selfish enjoyments." Now, whether it's back in the 70s or today, what we see on TV, happiness is buy this car, upgrade to this high-definition TV. Young people polled, they're asked what was their greatest desire. Fame and riches. Fame and riches came out on top. And a very unlikely source, the comedian Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey said, "I hope that these young people get the fame and riches that they want so they can realize it is not where happiness lies." I actually thought that was quite a good statement on his part. The historian Edward Gibbon commented on this pleasure-crazed ruin of Roman character in his book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. From the morning to the evening, spectators who sometimes amounted to 400,000 would be able to be seated in their largest stadium, their eyes being fixed on horses and charioteers. The happiness of Rome appeared to hang on the event of a single race. Is that very different from the eager buyers that we see sleeping overnight in front of ticket offices, waiting to buy World Series or Super Bowl tickets in the United States? We have sports heroes with multi-million-dollar salaries, gambling mania. You know, on our way to church, Sabbath services, week after week, we see the lottery board up there. I don't know how many millions it's up to right now. The average person actually believes the only way they'll ever become wealthy is by winning the lottery. Now, on to a different topic, but it relates to the idea of pleasing oneself, and that is a recent phenomenon, the increase in heroin deaths in the United States. The United States is struggling with an epidemic. I think we've all heard about that. It's reached a 20-year high, according to a United Nations report. Heroin-related deaths have increased significantly, and according to the UN's World Drug Report, the number of users in 2014 reached 1 million. 1 million people in this country use heroin, three times the number of 2003. And the number of deaths has increased by five times since the year 2000. It's a huge epidemic, and the highest definitely in the last 20 years. It's a sad comment. There's even a form of heroin I hadn't heard of, fentanyl, which is what killed the pop star Prince not too long ago. It is 50 times stronger than heroin, and it's out on the streets. Now, it may not affect our lives personally, but we may run into these people. We may see them actually on the streets. That terrible, terrible vision of the grandparents who were in a vehicle, and they were literally passed out while their grandchild was in the back. They were passed out because they were on drugs. Some of you may have seen that. Now we go on to the final factor, which is perhaps the most telling. That is the breakdown of the family. And the booklet mentions an author, Glenn Stanton, and his book called Why Marriage Matters. And in it, a Nobel laureate named Gary Beck comments this way: "The family in the Western world has been radically altered, some claim almost destroyed, by the events of the last three decades." And this was back in the 70s. I still remember seeing a booklet which was called Marriage Soon Obsolete. And just the title of it just sounded bizarre. It struck me as strange. I don't know, most of you grew up in a family where it was stable. There was a mother, there was a father, there was stability within the marriage, and that has totally changed. And we're going to see a little more of that in just a moment. A professor by the name of Lawrence Stone, who studies family history at Princeton University, said, "The scale of marital breakdown in the West since only 1960, this was in mid-70s that he spoke on this, has no historical precedent, nothing like it in 2,000 years. nothing like the breakdown of the family in 2,000 years. In 2002, Gallup survey called Values and Beliefs asked about the morality of having a baby outside marriage. And in 2002, 45%. 45% believed it was okay to have a child outside of wedlock. In 2016, it was up to 61% who thought that it was morally acceptable. It's bowing to a selfish concept that there ought to be sexual freedom without any regard to consequences and the selfishness of bringing a child into the world without a mother or father. Just imagine the financial, the social, and emotional difficulties of life without a mother or father. This historian also wrote of the danger of cohabitation and how it does not help marriage and, in fact, makes it more likely for divorce to occur. The research is out there. Cohabitation actually leads to greater numbers of divorces than those who do not. His statistics from this book I just mentioned, The Case for Marriage, are strong, they are convincing, and when he speaks of the benefits of men and women getting married versus the problems of divorce and remarriage. Now, in this culture, when traditional marriage is not highly valued due to experimentations with cohabitation, different forms of living, this author gives strong arguments for traditional marriage. He summarized years of research in a compelling and easy-read format, giving the reading new ways to think about the old tradition of marriage between a man and a woman. For us, this is common sense. But around the country, at this point in time, marriage is really in the doldrums. It's really not thought of very highly at all. By the time they are 20, one in four women from age 15 to 44 has lived with a man. By the time they are 30, the ratio climbs to 3 in 4. The percentage of women living with a partner opposed to marrying that partner has quadrupled from 3% in early 1980s to 11% in the latest survey. And the question becomes not who does cohabiting, but who does not cohabit. So what we see before our eyes is the foundation of society steadily eroding. The family, and from the family stem the source of values, of loyalty, of discipline, of honor. It's dying, it's disappearing before our eyes. CNN reported in October of last year, there were more reported cases of STDs than ever before in the United States. Oh, you think it would be under control. You think it would be dying down. Quite the opposite. The report is released annually and shows chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, the three most commonly reported, increased from between 2014 and reached an all-time high. Reported cases of primary, secondary syphilis rose by 19%. The numbers go on and on. From the CDC's National Center for HIV and AIDS, statement by the director says, we've reached a decisive moment in the nation. The rates of STDs are rising. Many of the country's systems for preventing them have eroded. We must mobilize, rebuild, expand services, or the human and economic burden will continue to grow. Now, this is one of the saddest of the four factors, and it hits home at a personal level. You know, despite using numbers, these are real people, real individuals who are suffering as a result. And what's the fuel for all the infidelity? You can guess the number one export. I won't do a pop quiz. This will be no surprise. It's invaded homes and workplaces through the internet. It is porn. Good Housekeeping Magazine reports the staggering actual amount of money resulting from what's the so-called porn industry and the number of people involved. 89% of pornography comes from the United States. 89%. $2.84 billion was generated just in 1 year, in the year 2006. You can guess that it's much higher by now. Now, I'm giving a lot of quotations from the booklet, The Modern Romans, and it's meant to show this sharp contrast with the way of life that we espouse, the way of life that we know produces all good. But with that, let's turn over to the book of Jeremiah. And as we're turning to it, the scripture came to mind. I didn't have a chance to look it up, that Israel was meant to be the city set on a hill. It was to be a beacon, a light to the nations. And so in Jeremiah 5 and in verse 7 to 10, I'll read it first in the New King James Version, then in a a more up-to-date modern interpretation. Jeremiah 5, verse 7, "How shall I pardon you for all this? Your children have forsaken me, have sworn by those that are not gods. When I fed them to the full, they committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. They were like well-fed, lusty stallions." God doesn't mix images, does he? "Everyone neighed after his neighbor's wife. Shall I not punish them for these things, says the Lord? Shall I not avenge myself on such a nation as this?" And here is the value of knowing what the signs are. I looked up a different, as I said, not a translation, but rather more an interpretation, which I think states it in a way that's very graphic. It's from called The Message. "Why should I even bother with you any longer?" This is God speaking. "Why should I bother with you any longer? Your children wander off, leaving me, taking up with gods that are not even gods. I satisfied their deepest needs, and then they went off with the, quote, sacred horrors. They left me for orgies and sex shrines. A bunch of well-groomed, lusty stallions pawing, snorting for his neighbor's wife. Do you think I'm going to stand around and do nothing? God's decree. Don't you think I'll take serious measures against a people like this?" And here is the danger, because while we might not relate to the heroin epidemic or the kind of mass adultery that goes on around us, nevertheless, this is the state of the union, if I may put it that way. So I'll end this section with just two names that are maybe emblematic of the attack on the family. You may have heard of Ashley and Madison, or more rightly, the Ashley Madison Agency. I'm rather ashamed to say it's a Canada-based online dating service. They call it a dating service. Social networking service marketed to people who are married who are in committed relationships. So more rightly defined, it's a company profiteering from the sizable market of adulterers seeking to hook up. No, as Solomon wrote, there's nothing new under the sun, only more imaginative ways to use technology to commit the same old sin. But these are not merely dry and cold statistics. They're living, breathing young people who have had taken from them opportunities, the hope, joy of having children, thinking especially of the numbers of young ladies these days who can't have children because of STDs. Rome faced a similar erosion of the family structure, but it was in vain. The emperors resorted to penalties and bounties and deprivations and privileges, entreaties, expostulations. The marriage estate continued to be held in great disesteem. In the same way, sadly, respect for marriage in the home is at the lowest ebb it's ever been in the United States and Britain. Marriage to many means little or nothing. And in any society where marriage, which the Creator gave us and intended to have the utmost meaning, is treated so lightly, where a solid family relationship is not desired, that society is threatened with extinction. Rome traveled this road. It weakened that society. And America, as well as Britain and the other English-speaking nations, even Western civilization, is speeding along the same roadway. So it's been a sobering message. And its impact on us as Christians is, I hope that we might be encouraged. Why? Because these are signs that we might see. Now, the title is The Path of the Romans, but really, it could have been how to avoid the path of the Romans. The Western world is pursuing this path of the Romans, but we can be forewarned to avoid these ways leading to destruction. Spanish philosopher named Santayana wrote in his book, The Life of Reason, a now famous quotation, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." I teach at a high school. Mr. May may back me up on this. Kids don't like history for the most part. Maybe he teaches it better than the teachers at our school. Maybe they love it. But they're just not aware. They're unaware of the history. And even when I had this book, The Modern Romans, at the time, much of it was Greek to me, no, Latin to me. It was incomprehensible, some of the readings. There was a whole chapter I've skipped over on the rise of homosexuality. I just really segued past that. I couldn't relate to it even in the slightest form at the time. Now, we don't want to go there. So that's why I rather skipped over it. But it's interesting to note that the name Manasseh, from which we believe the present-day United States has grown, the meaning of the name is forgetful. The meaning of Manasseh is forgetful. Now, a researcher of Roman history, an H.J. Haskell, said the following. It required a century or more for the destructive forces in Rome to work out their effects, but the modern tempo is faster. The history of the later Roman Empire carries a warning to present-day Caesars that they may bring about something that they may not understand is happening. So in conclusion, let's do a second bookend. We'll turn back to Matthew 24. That rather long prophecy, which, as we recall, started with the disciples asking, "Let us know the signs. How can we know that you are returning to us?" So Matthew 24 and in verse 36. But of that exact day and hour, no one knows. No one knows the exact day. We might know the season. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man, our Messiah, will be just like the days of Noah. For in those days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage. Nothing wrong with those activities when they're done rightly and in moderation. Until the very day when Noah entered the ark, and they did not know or understand till the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man, an unexpected judgment. Skipping on down to verse 45. So, be alert. Keep watch. Reading from the Amplified Version, give strict attention, be cautious, be active in your faith, for you do not know which day, whether it is near or whether it is far, that your Lord is coming. But understand this, if the head of the house had known what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert, would not have allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you, speaking of followers of Christ, you must be ready, because the Son of Man is coming in an hour when you do not expect him. So may we, brethren, be eager, as were the disciples of Jesus Christ, in desiring to see the signs that will lead to our Lord's return.